From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. The political gears are turning after the CDC decided yesterday to lift almost all mask mandates for fully vaccinated people. Today, Vermont joined the list of states immediately dropping most mask requirements. But in others, like New York, Massachusetts, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and California, it'll take a while longer.
And in Washington, the January insurrection continues to upend politics. This morning, New York Congresswoman Elise Stefanik was elected to House Republican leadership 2 days after rank-and-file members ousted Liz Cheney for continuing to criticize the former president for his role in the riot. Afterwards, Stefanik thanked Trump.
I believe that voters determine the leader of the Republican Party, and President Trump is the leader that they look to. I support President Trump. Voters support President Trump. He is an important voice in our Republican Party, and we look forward to working with him.
Our Friday Politics Roundtable joins us to put all of this in context. We have Margaret Tolove, who is managing editor at Axios, and Aisha Roscoe, who is NPR's White House correspondent. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tanya. Great to be with you.
Well, let's start with what happened this morning. New York House Republican Conference Leader Elise Stefanik of upstate New York was overwhelmingly elected. This happened really fast. What does that tell you, Aisha?
It tells me that the Republican Party is one that is, you know, if there was any question, I don't think there was, it is the party of Trump, and that is the main guiding light for them right now. Stefanik is more moderate. You know, Liz Cheney, which was much more conservative on policy compared to Stefanik, but Stefanik is much more loyal to Trump, and that's clearly what matters, and she had the backing of Trump.
Well, Margaret, let's bring you in here. Stefanik said House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has the slimmest majority in a generation. It's likely now that Republicans will take back the House. How are Republicans and Democrats positioning themselves for the congressional midterms?
This is so much about the midterms. And I think when you look at Stefanik, in many ways, she's sort of like the perfect symbol or microcosm of the evolution of the Republican Party in recent years. When she was elected in 2014, she was the youngest woman ever elected to Congress. And other than driving around like in a Ford F-150, she had so many of the markers of the old style of Republicans, right? She had worked in George W. Bush's administration. She had she went to Harvard, right? She'd done debate prep for Paul Ryan. That's not right. The Republican Party anymore. And Kevin McCarthy, his leadership team, have made the decision that their best chance at taking back Congress, their best chance at taking back the House next November, a year from November, is to wrap themselves in the mantra of Trump and be all in. And you keep hearing this word unity. You heard it in her remarks. You heard it in Kevin McCarthy's remarks. The idea that if they just rally around the former president, that's their best chance to get over the finish line. And so they're putting all their chips on that bet. And that's what we saw
Margaret,
this week.
Let me just interrupt you to say, if this is all about the midterms, and it's all in support of a former president who lost the last election.
That's what's so interesting about this is that you normally a former president, a one-term president, would slink off into the unknown where you don't really hear from them anymore. But they are making this bet that for their constituents, and you have to think about the House is very gerrymandered, that for their districts, that having Trump support will be enough to get them over the finish line.
Well, Stefanik said that Republican voters are unified in support of President Trump. We know that's not true. We're seeing more than 100 Republicans threaten to form a third party. These are prominent Republicans threatening to form a third party if Trump continues to perpetuate the lie that the election was stolen. What do you think about that effort? Is it going anywhere, Margaret?
If you look at the polling now, President Trump is still the closest thing to a unifying leader the Republican Party has. And so I think it depends a lot on things that happen in the months to come. There are investigations, including criminal investigations, that touch the former president. We just don't know how that will impact public opinion yet. And what you see Liz Cheney saying is the Republican Party is never going to get beyond Donald Trump if they embrace Donald Trump. So she's saying it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if they lose the next midterms. Doesn't matter what happens for 2024. To really reclaim the principles of the Republican Party, they need to cast him aside and step away from him, step away from the lie that the election was stolen. But if you look at the polling, Republicans are much more supportive of Donald Trump than they are of Liz Cheney at this moment. And that's where Kevin McCarthy's calculations come in. It's not about the truth or conservative principles. It's about winning in politics right now.
Let's talk about something else that happened this morning. The top Democratic and Republican lawmakers on the House Homeland Security Committee said that they had reached a deal on a bipartisan independent commission to investigate the January 6th storming of the U.S. Capitol. But we saw stark divides in that House hearing this week. Georgia Republican Andrew Clyde says what he saw was not an insurrection. Let's listen.
Watching the TV footage of those who entered the Capitol and walked through Statuary Hall showed people in an orderly fashion staying between the stanchions and ropes, taking videos and pictures. You know, if you didn't know the TV footage was a video from January the 6th, you would actually think it was a normal tourist visit.
This is really surprising to hear that, I mean, 400 people were arrested, 5 people died because of the violence that day that we actually saw with our own eyes. Do you think this commission is going to actually help us understand what happened? Aisha?
It's going to be difficult, and you still have Republican leaders who have to get on board with this. Kevin McCarthy has not said that he's on board with this deal that was reached.
I think we might have just lost Aisha.
I'm sorry, Margaret, Aisha, we just lost you. But Margaret, can you weigh in here? We're talking about this commission really helping us to understand what happened on January 6th.
The deal cut so far, assuming that Kevin McCarthy goes along with it and allows it to move forward, does allow a commission to move forward. But anyone who has worked in Washington knows that the ground rules for the commission are always incredibly important for how much digging can happen and what can get done. And right now, what we're looking at is a split formation of the commission, so a party split. You'd need a majority to sort of move elements forward. That's going to be really tough if Republicans, go back to that word unity, decide to unify to block something. It's going to affect everything like subpoenas. Who can a subpoena be issued on? What is going to be the scope of what the commission can investigate? Until we know all of that, until we see what the agreement is on that, we're not really going to have a sense of how deep and how substantial this can be. Can it be another 9/11 commission? I doubt it based on what we're seeing now, but it's something. It is something, and something will come out as a matter of course about it. It will allow the conversation to continue. Elements will be leaked. We all know how this works. So how profound, how deep can the investigation go? I think we don't know that yet, but some commission is better than no commission if you're looking at an avenue for information to come out.
Very quickly, we have Aisha Roscoe back with us. And Aisha, it was also Infrastructure Week, right? There were a lot of bipartisan meetings on this. Did any of it move the ball forward?
Well, what Biden said is that they were able to talk about, you know, both the White House's proposal on infrastructure, and that they expect that Republicans will come back with a counteroffer on what the White House proposed, and that discussions will continue. I imagine that it will still, you know, that they're still pretty far apart right now, so I don't think a deal is coming anytime soon, but they're still talking.
Well, Margaret, what do you think about what they're saying? In other words, is it just theater at this point for both sides to say, hey, we tried to be bipartisan, and now the Democrats are just kind of waiting out the clock to push through budget reconciliation again?
There's the two-word phrase to watch. It's called user fees, which translates to gas tax. The negotiations now are going to move to whether Democrats will agree to change the way this is paid for, to raise taxes, basically regressive taxes on a fee-for-service basis to help backfill some of this money. And then the question is, that's what Republicans are asking them to do. Are they asking them to do that because they think that's the right policy, or because they're going to let Democrats walk the ledge, go against Biden's promise not to raise taxes on anyone earning less than $400,000, then vote no for it and go into the midterm saying, look, Joe Biden and Democrats raised your taxes. So there is like a huge degree of mistrust and like one step forward, two steps back here. But Biden doesn't have very many other choices. Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema on his own side are holding back his ability to do what he wants without any Republican votes at this moment. So this is where he is, and it's going to be baby steps, and we'll see where it lands.
Got a minute left, Aisha. Let me just ask you, should we at all think that perhaps the CDC's decision on masking was political? And pardon my skepticism.
Well, you know what, you know, my colleague Tamara Keith has been reporting on this, and a White House official told her that, you know, the White House did not know about that President Biden did not know about this decision until Thursday morning. And the White House was informed the night before that it was a completely independent decision that was made by the by the CDC. And so that's what they say, that it wasn't, that they did not, that they worked independently.
All right. Aisha Roscoe, NPR White House correspondent, and Margaret Talev, managing editor at Axios. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks.
This time last year, when schools were trying to figure out how to operate during a pandemic, standardized testing was put on hold. Well, this week, state and federal testing has resumed, and it's igniting a long-standing battle over whether these kinds of tests should be used to measure students' abilities. Seth Lavin is a principal of an elementary school in Chicago, and he recently wrote about this for the publication Chalkbeat Chicago. Principal, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yes, thank you for being here. I suspect you've always felt strongly about the value of standardized tests, but how has this pandemic brought this into focus for you?
Yeah, I think anybody who experienced this pandemic connected to schools and saw the impact that it had on children and on their families and on their teachers feels an urgency of coming out of it better. And so coming out of the pandemic and watching kids come into the building and take this state test, as in some cases, the first thing they've done in a school building in 14 months, it feels more urgent than ever to say out loud, this is wrong.
Let's talk a little bit more about that. As you said, your students will be taking the state tests just a couple of weeks after returning to school in person. President Biden said federal standardized testing must be given this year. In your article, you paint this heartbreaking picture of your own children, your two boys still dealing with the impacts of a disrupted year, sitting in an empty gym for 6 hours taking a standardized test. How would you like the students' progress to be measured?
It's a great question. And I think it gets to a misconception some people have. I mean, to be anti-high-stakes testing, and in particular to be anti-high-stakes testing now, is not the same thing as being anti-assessment. We need to connect to our kids about where they've been and where they are and where they want to be. And none of that is something that we're going to learn from kids taking a multiple choice test for 6 hours.
Well, the argument for testing students this year in particular is that the results will give educators a handle on how far behind students are during this pandemic year. Wouldn't that information be helpful to you as an educator?
Sure. That's something that you have to do in the classroom, led by the teacher in a conscientious way that makes kids feel safe and engaged. And the teachers need to see the kids doing that work and understand how the kids are doing the work that they're doing in order to learn where they are and what they need. And that's just not what state testing gives us. The results that you get from state testing, you don't get for weeks and weeks later. These are accountability tests. And so the whole thing is bound up in evaluation of everybody involved, which means that it's very difficult to look at the results and learn anything from them because everybody's relationship to them is so fear-based. And the other thing is we're still in the pandemic. And so kids who are at home, the half of our kids who haven't returned yet, they're supposed to come in to the building to take this test, you know, and many of them didn't. And so if we're supposed to be able to look at these numbers and make some sort of global statement about how kids are doing, we just aren't able to.
What I'm hearing from you, Principal, is that now is as good a time as any to try something new.
You are right. For 20 years, there's been this pressure to make test scores go up in order to be good. That is the driving force of the school reform movement. And it works. It gets schools to change themselves into places that makes scores go up. And the problem is we've tricked ourselves into thinking that making scores go up is the same thing as being good. And in the pandemic, that whole machine broke. We have not been testing students. We have not been pushing forward test-based evaluations. There is a tremendous opportunity right now to rethink and renew and to change.
As you know, the opt-out movement is strong. We've actually seen some progress over the years on efforts to make things like scoring formulas more transparent.
Sure.
But ultimately, we are just a ways away from what you're talking about, from getting rid of standardized testing. With that, how are you preparing your students and your own children for the tests that they have to take ahead? Because the reality is they are going to have to do this, even though you feel very strongly, and I'm sure you've had lots of conversations with educators and parents.
Sure, sure. I mean, you have to be real with kids. Kids are smart. Kids are humans. People need to know what they're experiencing and what's ahead of them and what the stakes are. It's not empowering of me to withhold that information from anybody. And so you tell kids honestly, we're not going to have class tomorrow. Instead, this is what you're going to do. Here's what it means. Here's what it doesn't mean. Do the best that you can. And the other thing I would say is, again, being against the test is not saying we don't want to be challenged and we don't want to grow and we don't want to feel compelled to be better for our students. We do. It's a way of saying, let's talk honestly and clearly about what that means and what that doesn't mean, and let's do it in the right way for our kids and for ourselves. I want our kids in schools that are preparing them to make the world better. And I think there's a way in which the weight of the test score movement stops that.
That's Seth Lavin, an elementary school principal in Chicago. Principal, thank you so much for this conversation.
Sure. Thank you so much.
Now let's go back in time to a story about a bunch of bones. Ancient fossils can tell us a lot about history, but in Austin, Texas, there is a trove of million-year-old bones that are also teaching us about the much more recent past. And as KUT's member station reporter Mos Bouchel reports, they may also tell us about what's to come in a changing climate. The story aired on Here and Now 2 years ago.
That's right. The main characters in this story are a bunch of fossils.
You're about to head into the collections proper.
This is Chris Sagaville. He's the keeper of these ancient bones, officially the collections manager. They're stored in Austin in a huge World War II era warehouse. Now it holds row after row of shelves and cabinets. It's home to the University of Texas's vertebrate paleontology collection.
I never take this place for granted. Every day I come in, just love the environment. It's unique.
Isn't it? It's incredible. We're looking at these massive jawbones just kind of sitting on these shelves going up to the window here.
We've got a whole mammoth lower jaw. Looking at that number, I know that's one of our WPA specimens that was collected probably 1939.
WPA, 1939? What is he talking about? Turns out a lot of these fossils were gathered in the 30s, back when the economy was in the ditch.
The Great Depression left millions of able and willing Americans bewildered and jobless.
But the federal government had a plan. It launched the Works Progress Administration.
To take care of the unemployed, as well as to confer real and lasting benefits on the people of the United States, is the object of the WPA. Under this program, work pays America.
The government paid people to build roads, it paid people to paint murals, and in Texas, it paid people to dig up old bones. At least for a little while.
And then World War II happened, and that put an end to the research that was planned for all these different fossils.
So they just sat here, some in the same burlap and plaster packaging that they were wrapped in by those WPA workers 80 years ago. That is, until recently.
You should see the basement.
Let's go.
Yeah.
Sagaville leads me down a flight of stairs and unlocks the door to the lower level.
There's a lot more.
Things seem a little less tidy down here. It's more cramped and more of the bones sit out in the open.
So the material Steve was interested in are mainly along this wall.
Steve is UT researcher Stephen May. About 5 years ago, he reopened that old WPA collection and started poking around.
So, for example, we have a new gomphotherium, one of these kind of elephant-like creatures, that we've given it a new name, Blancotherium.
This is Steve May.
there's a fossil of something that's sort of a coyote-sized dog-like creature.
He says it could be a very early ancestor of modern dogs.
So there's some aspects like that that are very exciting.
But beyond new species, he says another interesting thing about the WPA fossils is their diversity. The collection paints a detailed picture of what South Texas looked like about 10 million years ago, long after the dinosaurs, but long before the arrival of humans.
So we have elephant-like creatures.
Camels.
Camel with a very long neck, so it's sort of giraffe-like.
Horse fossils.
So think zebra.
A weird alligator.
We have these rhinos.
Really a bizarre concept to think about rhinoceroses running around the state of Texas.
May has a term for this ancient time. He calls it the Texas Serengeti.
You start thinking about that composition of a fauna, and it sounds very much like some of the modern African savanna-type faunas today.
But hearing that, you've got to wonder, what happened to all these animals?
Well, that's a good question.
Experts say it was probably a bunch of things that wiped out most of them, even as their ancestors survived on faraway continents.
Of course, we don't know exactly.
Theories range from asteroids to overhunting when humans arrived. But Chris Sagaville says,
climate change is my preferred answer to that. There were large changes in the climate at the same time that all the large mammals in North America went extinct.
And by the time their bones were pulled from the ground in the 1930s, the Earth was again experiencing a changing climate. This one caused by man. The effects of that global warming are now accelerating. And that's why Sagaville thinks this research could be more important today than it was even back then.
So we can see what we might expect in the future, how quickly those effects can trickle down to the animals.
And there's still plenty more to study. There are still dozens of fossil packages in UT's collection that haven't even been opened. They could hold anything from a previously unknown animal to new clues about a great extinction. For Here and Now, I'm Mose Bouchel.
Good question.
That's a really good question.
It's a great question.
This is free therapy.
Thank you for asking me that.
God, that's such a good question.
That's an interesting question.
But what Fresh Air interviews are really about are the interesting answers. Listen and subscribe to Fresh Air from WHYY and NPR.
Bitcoin is down 13% this week because, well, Elon Musk said something about it again. The Tesla CEO tweeted that the company would stop accepting the cryptocurrency because of environmental concerns. Every year, Bitcoin consumes about as much energy as countries like Malaysia or Sweden, and cryptocurrencies have bounced around in price for months, pretty much depending on what Elon Musk is tweeting about. Here to talk about this is Mike Regan. He is senior editor at Bloomberg News. Mike, welcome back.
Thanks, Peter.
How much energy does it take to make Bitcoin, and why?
Well, as you point out, without a doubt, it's a huge energy hog. Cambridge University in England has been tracking the energy usage from Bitcoin transactions. They put it on par with Argentina, the entire country of Argentina, as far as how much energy is used. And the reason is what's known as mining. And that is basically these massive arrays of computers around the world, which provide all the computational power that's needed to track all the Bitcoin transactions and to safeguard the integrity of the entire network around the world. And in exchange for that service, the miners are paid with new Bitcoins that are created in the process. But Peter, obviously, this is a super hog on energy around the world, this whole process.
And Elon Musk isn't the only one who's talking about it. Even the Treasury Secretary, Janet Yellen, has called Bitcoin extremely inefficient. Who else is calling out that environmental impact? And what does it actually mean for the cryptocurrency's value?
There is a widespread outcry against the energy use. As far as the value, I think the key here is how cryptocurrencies have really thrived amid this very hands-off approach from government regulators, in large part because cryptocurrency doesn't exactly fit right into the coverage area of most financial regulators. So the back of the mind worry for crypto investors is when you hear of something like Janet Yellen talking about its inefficiency, there's this worry that some kind of regulatory scrutiny is coming down the pike, whether it be based on energy or crypto's use in money laundering. Even the Colonial Pipeline that was hacked last week, the hackers demanded payment in cryptocurrency. So any sort of whiff of regulatory scrutiny coming down the pike tends to cause traders to freak out and sell the cryptocurrency. And obviously, Peter, that leads to lower prices for the cryptocurrency like we saw this week.
And how would you even regulate? Because Bitcoin mining, it's decentralized. There's no single entity or person that you can go to with these complaints. And it just makes me think that a pressure campaign on how much carbon it's burning isn't going to do much to make it more environmentally friendly.
Well, yeah, and I also think it's important to point out that the advocates of Bitcoin, like this guy Nick Carter, who is very influential in the industry, they point out that a lot of these mines are located in places where there is a surplus of energy. For example, in China, there are a lot of Bitcoin mines that are located in a region with a lot of hydroelectric power being provided. So a more green source of power than, say, a coal or a gas-fired power plant. And, you know, he claims that this energy would simply not be used if the mines weren't there to buy it. But I think at the end of the day, there's not really a full accounting of exactly how big the carbon footprint from Bitcoin is.
Mike Regan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter.
How do you define what it means to be a man? That's the question podcast host Aarti Shahani posed to former President Barack Obama. And it's a question the former president says he's not only grappling with, it's the defining question, he says, America needs to ask itself.
I think that oftentimes the narrow definitions that we provide our boys growing up about what it means to be strong, powerful, admired a man seep into how we think about public policy and how we organize our societies, and often is a stunted view.
Shahani recently spoke with Obama on her podcast, Art of Power, which explores how people view the role of power in our world. And Aarti Shahani joins me now. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Tanya.
So you knew right from the start that you didn't want to talk policy with the former president. You wanted to go deeper. You wanted to have a more human level conversation. Why was it important for you to take it there?
I mean, obviously, there's no shortage of policy conversations you could have with him, given his enormous footprint. But I believe that our country is at a pretty dramatic crossroads where we are questioning what are our values anyway? What does it mean to be a good citizen, a good person? And I feel like what I've observed in President Obama, you know, reading his latest memoir, listening to him speak, just paying attention to what he's saying and doing, is I kind of saw from a distance, oh, this guy is thinking a lot about manhood.
Yeah, absolutely. And this comes up actually in the context of a convo you two had about his race for Senate after he was defeated in a congressional race. And he uses this word megalomaniac to describe himself in that moment. Let's listen to some of that.
By definition, when you offer yourself up as a political leader, you're going out there and you're saying, vote for me and I will represent you and be your voice. You have to have a certain ego that probably tips beyond healthy and into sometimes a little delusional.
And Obama says he was actually driven into politics by his own ego. Why was that awareness so important?
You know, what I will say first is it is remarkable how self-aware he is. And that becomes a central part of our conversation. You know, a point he makes is even if you're ego-driven, even if you're not doing things for the purely righteous, selfish motivations, because very few people do, know why you do things. He referred to, for example, his wife in their many years together, his wife prompting him to really ask himself questions like, are you doing this because it's important, or are you doing this because your father left you, you have a hole in your heart, and you're being reactive? So he really thinks about the fundamentals. And I think maybe we all do, but what's distinct in him is his ability to voice what is happening in his inner life, right? So in some ways, I actually feel like he's doing a lot of work for other people right now, specifically other men, by saying, hey, this is the journey we're on.
Mm-hmm. Well, this reflective interrogation of all of this and of masculinity continued, as you said, in talking about Michelle Obama. Obama says the responsibilities of taking care of two daughters inevitably fell unevenly on Michelle. What did he say about breaking this cycle, about why we don't teach men to be better caregivers?
You know, I really want to follow up on that part of our conversation, to be honest with you. Or rather, yeah. I want to hear him and Michelle talk about it publicly, him and Mrs. Obama, because what he did very candidly was acknowledge that there is a generational thing happening, right? He talked about, for example, Michelle Obama's parents being of a certain ilk, of a certain way of being. He and Michelle progressed beyond that in terms of the load that they shared, but by no means equal. He doesn't pretend that they were equal. And then he sees in his daughters, you know, the great thing about raising daughters is it really forces a man to think about his male privilege in a way that he never has before. You know, and he observes in his daughters this sacrificing that his wife did, that she talks about, that he talks about, that we as a country celebrate, right? There's this notion of, you know, Michelle Obama handling so much while her husband is out and about. This notion of sacrifice, you know, he says it's one that his daughters and their generation don't want. And so he, I think in that respect, you know, I'd asked him at some point, I was like, do you want your daughters to end up with a guy like you? You know,
yeah.
I just want to know because you know what, like, and he was like, there's a generational shift and, you know, they are going to want the next iteration of things. And I actually think that that point that he made about the evolution and that maybe even he and Mrs. Obama did not live the kind of equality he'd like to see us march towards. It's simply an acknowledgement that, you know what, there's an arc to progress and you keep riding it, right?
And in many ways, as you actually said in the podcast, this was revelatory parenting advice.
Oh my God. I mean, like, you know, Tanya, I'm of Indian origin, okay? And I know how our aunties and uncles and parents are. And the pressure to get married as soon as you're fertile is off the charts. And, you know, President Obama was like, wait, don't get married too early. Make sure you take your time to understand who you are. And I really want everyone who pressures their kid to not be a spinster to heed what Barack Obama is saying there.
Mm. This line he draws, Arthi, from his own personal journey into manhood to our society's narrow definitions of masculinity to public policy. Mm-hmm. Let's listen.
Part of what we have to do is to expand our notions of manhood and power so that providing people health care and caring for children and being good stewards of the environment, that's what men do, as opposed to just going to war and making lots of money and, you know, telling other people what to do.
You two talked quite a bit about this point, about the messages we give our boys on what it means to be men. What was your takeaway here?
You know, he's making a point that I think has been far too quieted as we see the Me Too movement unfold, as we talk about equality, as we talk about, quote unquote, toxic masculinity. And the point he's making is actually we are increasingly giving girls permission to be as they are. Are you ambitious? Are you more stay at home? Are you extroverted and out there? Do you want to be sort of quieter inside? Girls, you can be who you want to be, but boys, here's the archetype, you better follow it. And, mm-hmm. you know, as far as I can tell, that is a wildly under-discussed part of the equality conversation. Do we actually give boys permission? Like, really? You know, the conversation about masculinity is not simply, hey, you should do this because it's better for women. It's if you give permission to yourself to be different from the, you know, alpha male dominant archetype, you might live a fuller, more rewarding life and be a better leader, right? Because that's where you see the conversation from child rearing and culture go into policy, which is that, you know, when you teach a boy, success means money, girls, and, you know, fighting or sports, you're also teaching him what matters. What do you bother legislating? What do you bother funding? Are you going to war or not? That kind of thing. When you teach values of nurturing, you're encouraging boys who grow up into men to be leaders who think, for example, about being stewards of the environment, right? And that's where, you know, I would say, Tanya, for me in interviewing various leaders, you know, not just President Obama, who I had the privilege of speaking with this time around, but I believe that right now, as particularly America is sorting itself out, there are kind of archetypically two leaders I see emerging. One that has the zero-sum mindset, like, hey, it's you or me, one of us is going to win and it better be me. And the other that has a far more collectivist mindset, the my well-being is connected to your well-being. And those things are battling it out deeply. And obviously, Obama falls into the latter camp.
Aarti Shahani, thank you so much for sharing a bit of your podcast with us.
Oh, thank you, Tanya.
That's Aarti Shahani, host of WBEZ's podcast, Art of Power, talking about her interview with former President Barack Obama.
One of Amazon Prime's newest shows is getting a lot of attention for how it depicts the trauma Black people experienced when they were enslaved and how it ties to their descendants' pain today. The Underground Railroad is the story of an enslaved woman named Cora who escapes from a plantation. Her mother fled when Cora was just a child, and Cora's suffered for years because she was left behind. And there's something else you need to know about this. The Underground Railroad carrying Cora to freedom is an actual underground train. Let's talk about it with NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Hey, Eric.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Right. So, Eric, tell me more about the journey that this show is taking people on. What do we need to know?
Well, if you've read the book that this is based on, the Underground Railroad, or if you've read books like Beloved, you know that there's a genre of books where it's grounded in authentic fact, but it also has this sort of magical realism to it. So Cora is stuck on this plantation and decides to run away, and they head for the Underground Railroad. And in this world, the Underground Railroad is an actual railroad with railroad cars and a locomotive, and it's underneath the ground. What pushes her into leaving is that a sadistic white man takes over running the plantation that his brother used to own, and he lays down the law with his slaves, letting them know that things are going to be tougher for them. And we have a clip of that. Let's listen to it.
My brother and I have a very different approach to the conditioning and coordination of slaves. Accordingly, there will be no more parties. Wages earned in town on Sundays will be subject to a tariff. And to ensure the propagation of the best stock, I will personally oversee the pairing and practices in the ways of breeding.
And, you know, one of the reasons this show is getting so much attention is because it has some incredibly graphic scenes. In the first episode, we see a runaway slave being burned alive. Of course, there's no doubt these sorts of things happened. But what do you make of the way that the show depicts them?
Well, you know, what I've always said is that when it comes to depictions of extreme violence against people of color and against Black people, there has to be a reason. And I do have to say that once you watch the entire 10-episode limited series, you will see that it is necessary so that you can appreciate a later time in the narrative where they find an oasis.
Barry Jenkins is the director of this series. This is also the man who directed Moonlight, which won an Oscar back in 2017. That film was very much praised for its nuanced depiction of Black lives. Do you see the same thing here with the Underground Railroad?
Well, what's great about the Underground Railroad and what was wonderful about Moonlight is that Barry Jenkins is a very visual filmmaker. And so he has a very deliberate storytelling style. He has a very beautiful storytelling style. And he makes the Black people in this story look beautiful, even when they're enduring horrific hardship and horrific circumstances. And it helps add to the magical realism so that when you see that locomotive or when you see someone walk down a hallway and they're surrounded by fireflies, you accept it because you've already seen him present a really beautiful tableau, and then it just kind of transitions into the magical realism parts.
That horrific hardship you're referencing, you know, if you look across TV, this is happening elsewhere as well, depictions of it. Amazon's Them, another recent example that shows Black pain. There's also Netflix's Two Distant Strangers. These are both controversial as well because they're showing these hardships so explicitly, the Black abuse, and critics say that they're trading on trauma. When you look at all of these shows in this moment, how is this being received in TV? How are producers handling these types of questions?
Well, you know, as I said before, you know, the question is, does the storytelling sort of warrant subjecting us to these images? And in the case of Them, for example, I was not as impressed with the ultimate story they were telling, in part because I had already seen other TV shows tell the story in a similar way, including Lovecraft Country on HBO. With Them, I just sort of felt like it wasn't worth it to me.
Right. Well, you know, we're having this conversation pretty soon after Derek Chauvin was convicted of killing George Floyd. We're now waiting for him to be sentenced. It was televised. That was traumatic for many people. It was, of course, traumatic for many people to watch George Floyd die under Derek Chauvin's knee. Do you think the Underground Railroad, considering some of the things it depicts, is that something that we need to see right now?
We're in a situation now where Black people have been forced to prove systemic racism and policing by constantly showing America and the world images of Black people being killed. And so I would not blame some people for deciding, you know what, I don't need to experience a fictional version of that. But I would also say the reason why we're forced into the situation of having to show people these images, like, that's what the Underground Railroad is talking about. Those issues, systemic racism, the toxicity of white supremacy, the way in which it constantly emerges to make Black joy short-lived in America. I encourage people to involve themselves with this narrative and absorb the lessons that it has, even though the trauma parts of it will be very tough to watch.
NPR TV critic Eric Deggans, thank you.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.